Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung and the Wadawurrung people of the Eastern Kulin Nation, and we wish to acknowledge them as traditional owners. We would also like to pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening.
Going to Barney Dune.
Woo!
Hello and welcome to Chickstory, the podcast that is rewriting the history books to include the women that were written out of them. My name is Annie and I'm definitely not a historian.
And I'm Phoebe, and I'm an actual historian and the owner of Born and Bred Historical Research.
I like to think I'm an historian when I do this podcast.
Yeah. Well, you're a super sleuth. You do the digging, you do the research.
Do.
You're halfway there.
I play the pretensies.
Mm.
Well, and, pretend.
You know, you wear that Sherlock Holmes cap all the time.
When we record, totally. And my brown trench coat.
Yeah.
You guys can't see that, but I do every week and I love it. If you're new to the podcast, we have this podcast that you're listening to right now, and it's about chicks in history. And we tell each other stories about women in history who have done amazing things, but don't get the credit they deserve. Isn't that right, Phoebe?
That's right. Very succinct. That's it.
She's nodding.
Boom. I'm nodding. Oh, God. Sometimes I forget this is not a visual medium. Yeah. You'd think I would have learnt by now, wouldn't you? I'm agreeing wholeheartedly.
Yes, she's agreeing. But before we do that, we have a little thing called Chick Picks, where we give you a little recommendation, because outside of this podcast, we have lives and they involve, for me, listening to a lot of podcasts, and for Phoebe's, reading a lot of books. So we thought,
we've got really interesting lives. We just listen to podcasts and read books. That's all we do. And talk about our dogs. That's it.
Don't you want to be our friends? Chick Picks. So, okay, I'm going to tell you about a podcast that I've been listening to. I've been a fan of this one for a little while, but I'm really enjoying it. And the guys, he's kind of going off on a few little tangents, which I really like. It's called 1 Minute Remaining. Have I told you about that one before?
It's ringing a bell, but tell me again.
Yeah. Well, listeners, I'm sorry if I have told you about this one before, but I am experiencing a little bit of amnesia lately. I blame it on the hormones and my age. So let's just go with it. Yes, so it's called 1 Minute Remaining, and it is by a guy called Jack Lawrence, and he is a journalist, but he's got this podcast where basically he has phone call conversations with inmates who are currently in prison. So, and he started off kind of, you know, and he says at the beginning, like, I'm not trying to, you know, find out if these people are innocent or, you know, trying to kind of make light of the facts. I mean, a lot of the people he speaks to do admit to their crimes, but then they talk about kind of how they've trying to turn their life around. And yeah, so each episode he'll talk to someone who is in prison, but it just so happens that a lot of the stories he tells are people who claim they're innocent, which is pretty standard for most people in prison. Things, you know, do say that they're innocent. But a few of them, you do listen to the stories and think, how the hell, you know, did that person end up in jail? And it's just, it's you know, it's horrifying to think that, you know, that can kind of happen. You know, one guy was just completely not even in the same state as the crime that was committed. And they, you know, say that he hired an aeroplane, a jet plane, to get to the crime scene and commit the crime. Like, it's just ridiculous. So, yeah, so give that a listen. 1 Minute Remaining.
And a quick chick pick book pick. A book called The Tea Ladies by Amanda Hampson. And it's set in the swinging 60s in Sydney. And it's about a group of tea ladies. So these ladies would serve tea and refreshments in factories. So they're quite... I think they're supposed to be dowdier than they are. They're probably only in their, you know, 50s. said in the book. Right. And it's about them being caught up in a crime and becoming amateur detectives. It's just a really heartwarming and funny and very witty book. So recommend awesome. The Tea Ladies by Amanda Hampson. Okay, the sources, some of the sources I have used for today's episode include the Australian Dictionary of Biography, Trove, National Museum of Australia, Public Records, held at the Public Record Office Victoria, the Australian Women's Register, the Australian Women's Archives Project, and Deadly Story, which is a website I think you should check out. Let me set the scene. It's 1838. Samuel Morse gives the first public demonstration of his electric telegraph in Philadelphia. Convict transportation to Australia peaks 5 years earlier when nearly 7,000 people arrive in 1 year. And Anne Fraser Dougal is born in Scotland, a champion of Aboriginal rights, a farmer and a philanthropist. This story is set on the land of the Tungurung people who were connected to this place for more than 2,000 generations and is rich with resources of rivers, creeks and tributaries and floodplains. So I just want to note that throughout this episode of Chickstory, I have used some language which was pertinent to the time and was used in the time, and in particular names of by government agencies. These names and phrases are true to this particular era. Anne Fraser Dougal was born in the small inland Scottish village of Dunning in Perthshire in 1838 and was a daughter of David Dougal, a physician, and Jane Fraser. On the 12th of January 1858 in Scotland, when she was 20 years old, Anne married John Bonn, who was 30 years her senior and by then quite a wealthy farmer. You want to add something to the end of that, don't you, John Bonn?
You do, you need. John Bon Jovi, no.
Not quite. So John had migrated to Australia in the late 1830s and had seen great success in his pastoral pursuits after facing ruin in his own homeland in his early working life. John had been chosen by Watson and Hunter, a Scottish pastoral company who had extensive pastoral runs around the Port Phillip district, which is Victoria, as we know it today, to take stud cattle to Wappen on the Delatite River near Mansfield. John's hard work paid off, and in 1857 he returned to Scotland for a visit and to pay off his remaining debts, during which time he proposed to Anne. However, technically, he actually proposed to her mother and elder sister for their permission to marry.
Oh, what a gentleman.
I know, isn't it? Anne and John married during his brief return trip to Scotland in 1858. 1 month after they married, Anne and John embarked at Liverpool on the Arcadia, which was bound for the colonies. They spent about 3 months at sea and arrived on the 14th of May, 1858, to the port of Melbourne. The couple were moving with the intention of settling permanently. The overseas travel was not easy, it was lengthy, and it was not without risks. Therefore, even the wealthy did not travel seamlessly. The Bonds were to return to Wappen Station, which John had purchased in 1846. The Wappen Run is on the land of the Tungurung people, and European settler history dates to the 1830s when squatters, including Watson and Hunter, came in search of good grazing land. Whilst Wappen, as we speak of it in this story, is located near Mansfield, the original pastoral run stretched from Bonnie Doon to Maryjig and was broken up into four grazing properties called Preston, Mount Battery, Loyola Delatite, and Wappen. The latter station was where John and Anne Bond settled. Anne was starting a new and unknown life in Australia and brought with her a piano, a cargo of bulbs, seeds, shrubs and fruit trees, five servants and what is said to have been enough hand-woven linen to last her a lifetime. And I suppose she had no clue what she was coming to.
Not a piano.
I know, and she's not the only one. Do you remember when Mary Penfold bought her piano as well?
Yes, yeah. I mean, piano, I think we said this, pianos are hard to move around these days.
I know.
Like, you need specialist people to, you know.
And just popping that on a
ship. Put them in and out of windows.
Exactly. Yeah. And John was also not without his cargo on their journey and brought with him a champion Clydesdale stallion and a celebrated bull.
Okay, good. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. I have one ticket for me, my wife, and my stallion and my bull. Thank you.
It's funny because I looked at the passenger list and there was only about eight people on it. So I'm wondering if, because John was quite wealthy by this point, I'm wondering if it was a specialist trip that was right. wealthier people and their cargo like this, rather than, you know, some of these yeah. immigrant ships were taking up to 250, 270 people at a time. So the newlyweds made their way to Wappen, which John already knew well. However, we can only imagine what a shock it must have been for 20-year-old Anne. However, mountainous and experiencing cold and snowy winters in Scotland, the terrain and environment would have been a big change from all that she had known and come from. The couple settled, and by the second year at Wappen, and then for 8 years to 1868, Anne and John had five children, two daughters and three sons. Sadly, they lost one daughter in infancy. Even with the arrival of her five children in quick succession, Anne was increasingly active in the management of the station with the backing and support of her husband. John was said to be a well-respected and humane man, and he and Anne were said to have made their property a safe haven for the local Tungurung people whom the land had belonged. Sadly, in 1868, after 10 years of marriage and the arrival of five children, John Bond died unexpectedly, leaving Anne a widow with a young family. She became known as the Widow of Wappen around the district and was said to have mirrored Queen Victoria in her demeanour. However, Anne had no time to rest on her laurels and quickly went about not only raising her children, but taking over the management of Wappen Station and remained in complete charge until her sons were old enough to share in the work, and then only under her direction. She was said to have managed the large property with great foresight and determination. Her strong faith helped her, and she was said to be a loving but stern mother, an autocrat with her domestic staff and station hands, and quite often was seen to have defied authority by merely managing her property.
Amazing.
Defying authority would be that she was a woman in a man's role and had strong and valid opinions, which she voiced. She, in essence, ruffled some feathers, much to the disdain of many around her. Anne was also said to be quite shy and had few close friends, however, was always there for those in need, especially the local Aboriginal people whom she showed great compassion and generosity. Whilst Anne and John, when he was still alive, created a refuge for the Tungurung people at Wappen, in the early 1860s, they were resettled at Corranderk Station on Wurundjeri country near Healesville. When those who settled at Corranderk returned to Wappen for the annual shearing season, Anne made sure she was kept informed about their treatment by the Board of the Protection of Aborigines and was open to receiving any information or concerns from those who were now living at the station. Anne became a friend and ally to William Barrack, who was said to have visited Wappen Station when John was still alive, when the Tungurung people would hold ceremonies on the property. It was said that Anne and William had bonded over their shared grief of the loss of a child, which would see a friendship that spanned four decades. During this time, Anne had also had a home in Kew in the inner suburbs of Melbourne, which she converted into a refuge for the sick and needy. William brought his dying son to the refuge in Kew in 1881, and Anne helped him take his son to the Melbourne hospital, where William was not allowed to be with his son when he died. Not only did Anne stay with William's son as he was dying, she also often visited Aboriginal people in Melbourne hospitals where no others were allowed entry or they had no one else close by to stay with them.
Wait, so the dad wasn't allowed?
No,
so the, because so William was Aboriginal?
Yes, yep.
He wasn't allowed to he wasn't go allowed, into the hospital?
Yeah, because she essentially took his son into the hospital, but because he was Aboriginal, he wasn't allowed to be with his son.
Awful.
Yeah, so she was a proxy, I suppose, but just to have someone there in their, last moments.
Yeah.
The tragedy of William Barrack's son's death spurred Anne on to pressure the Victorian government into conducting an inquiry into the management of Corranderk. Through her objections, questions, and copious letter writing, she became a thorn in the side of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. In 1879, her efforts to provide jobs and clothing to those in need, including Aboriginal people, she was accused of interference and was rebuked. She was in support of First Nations resistance to increasing state regimes of control and surveillance, much to the angst of her peers and those in government. She continued to support Aboriginals who opposed Protection Board policy, and using her influence with leading Presbyterian clergymen and politicians, she persuaded the government to investigate the conditions at Corranderk Station in 1881. She accepted membership of the inquiry and succeeded in reversing the policy. She was the first and only woman to sit on the inquiry. However, despite that inquiry, conditions at Corranderk did not improve, and in 1882 she wrote a letter, which I will read portions of. She said, "I am sure you will not regard it as presumption on my part to make a few suggestions regarding the future management of the Aborigines at Corranderk. We have robbed them of their beautiful colony, deprived them of their hunting fields and fishing grounds, and given them in return our vices and diseases, which are rapidly doing their work. Decency forbids me to mention the disease from which I have seen them suffer, even the little children sharing in its bad effects. Corranderk, they state they received from the Queen at the hands of Sir Henry Barclay as a small substitute for the country they had lost. They regard it as their own property and are exceedingly attached, I may say wedded to it. Then why drive them from it?" The letter goes on to say that they have had possession of Corranderk for 20 years, and why punish them for the bad management of the protectors? They are neither paupers, lunatics, nor criminals, then why treat them as such? They possess far more intellect than they get credit for, and the greatest crime of which they have been guilty is having been the original owners of the soil. Our grand mistake has been ignoring of the suggestions made by the Royal Commission in 1877, one of which is that the land be vested in the names of trustees. They have been deplorably neglected both in health and in sickness, sent to our large hospitals to die amongst strangers, although their dying request has been invariably, take me home to die among my own people. So the letter goes on. It was quite lengthy, but invariably after correspondence back and forth and the inquiry, the board deemed the Aboriginals at Corranderk were not Victoria's responsibility. They're just passing the buck, essentially. Shocker.
Yeah, geez, I just got goosebumps. Okay.
So she faced much antagonism of the officials who prevented her appointment to the Protection Board. However, she continued her fight and aimed her issues to members within the government rather than directly to the board. In 1904, she became the first woman to be appointed to the board and held her position and attended meetings until her death more than 30 years later. Throughout this time, she also maintained voluminous correspondence with Aboriginal people all over Victoria and remained responsible to them. This in itself earned her reprimands for her disloyalty in 1921, 1923, and 1936, when she protested to the minister that her colleagues' decisions had caused injustice or hardship. Anne was a strong ally to the First Nations people of the Kulin Nation, and her philanthropic support knew few bounds. She was a member of the First Ladies Committee of the Austin Hospital, which had also been established by another remarkable woman named Elizabeth Austin and had been founded in 1882. And Anne went on and became quite a generous benefactor. She was a foundation member of the Committee of the Charity Organisation Society, which had been established in 1887 to help coordinate Melbourne's charitable organisations and foster the ideal of self-help in the poor. This society played a role in the development of the social work profession in Victoria, as we would know it today. Anne was also a lifelong supporter of the Salvation Army. She established a school for Chinese children in Melbourne and was said to be a champion of the Chinese in Victoria. She worked towards a more enlightened approach to mental illness and brought patients from state mental institutions to Wappen, where they could enjoy the comforts of her home and family life rather than being confined to asylums and institutions in Melbourne.
It's just ingrained in her to just help people. She's just amazing.
I know. There's just so many facets. In 1915, in the early days of the First World War, she donated a motor ambulance, as opposed to a horse-drawn ambulance, to the Belgian Army, and each Christmas she gave £20 to every blinded soldier in Victoria.
Oh, my God!
And I don't know the numbers on that, but I'd imagine it's high.
Yeah.
In late 1917, she loaned her pet cockatoo, known as Cocky, to the number one rest home in Melbourne for returned soldiers. I know, this is just I just love this story. I know. She thought that Cocky would cheer up the wounded soldiers who were undergoing rehabilitation. He seemed to do the trick. However, Cocky quickly learned some colourful language and even a few words of German, and the nurses refused to repeat the phrases he mimicked.
Oh, that's funny.
I know. He was returned to Anne a few years later and lived until 1925 and was 47 years old when he died.
Wow.
No, yeah. I didn't know cockies had such a long lifespan.
Actually, I just read a news article about two. It was two. I think parrots or something, and they had to be separated because they were kept swearing at the visitors and then laughing. I'm just quietly obsessed with birds who talk.
Like, that's funny. It's just like those naughty school kids. Yeah, naughty school kids sitting in the back of the room that have to get separated. Yeah.
But that's such a great idea that she thought that would be therapy just, bird.
Yeah. So the bird was born and, as a hatchling out at Wappen, and then, she reared it.
Amazing.
So after Cocky's death, Anne had him dispatched in a blue velvet-lined case to a taxidermist at the Museum of Victoria in Melbourne, and he was then donated to the Australian War Memorial, where he remains in their collection.
No way!
I know!
That's brilliant!
Anne Fraser Bond died at 98 years old in 1936. Oh, I know. She's in her 99th year. I think she wasn't far away from being 99. That's a long life.
Mm. Yes.
So after living her latter years as a virtual recluse in the Windsor Hotel, her home at Wappen had been compulsorily acquired for the state government for the establishment of the new irrigation systems and the construction of the Sugarloaf Weir and Lake Eildon, and therefore she was forced to move. When this notice of acquisition arrived, Anne moved the monument she had constructed in memory of her late husband and child who had both died previously. The monument had been inscribed with her husband and child's name, and she did not want it to remain on the property or be destroyed. At the same time that this was happening, her longtime friend William Barrack passed away. Anne engaged some tradespeople to scratch the names of the monument and re-inscribe it with the name of William Barrack, which she then had moved to the Corranderk Aboriginal Cemetery to honour him. Her philanthropy continued even after her death with bequests to the Austin Hospital, the Royal Victorian Eye and Ear Hospital and St Andrew's Presbyterian Hospital. And that is the story of Anne Fraser Bond.
What an extraordinary woman.
She packed a lot in.
Her whole life was just dedicated to helping people. She's that's incredible. Yeah. Amazing.
And the fact that she ran the property. So, because her children were young when their father died, so she was in charge and, they would run in conjunction with her, but she was in charge for that whole time.
Yeah, and it's funny, we've told a lot of stories about women who would come out and something's happened to the husband and then they've had to go on to kind of run the station or run the farm or run the, that's incredible because, they didn't have any other choice, right? They'd moved their whole life over here and then they just have to learn.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But, women couldn't be recognised as farmers until when? The 1990s? Don't get us started.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
How ridiculous. That was great. And that was a really good one for today because I was in a little bit of a funk. And when I was listening to all of that, I was like, pull your socks up. Stop being such a pork chop. Look at this amazing woman who just, has given her whole life to helping people. Just incredible.
Mm. Just the way that she spoke in her correspondence as well about the First Nations people and traditional owners is it's
exactly
and amazing.
When you were reading that, I was thinking, I was like, oh, that's amazing. She's, and then I thought, she's just being a human. Like she's just being human and going, well, these people deserve just as much, as we do, and let's acknowledge the fact that, what we've done. And there were so many people who couldn't see that.
No.
Australia, who couldn't see that. That was just...
It's a sense of entitlement.
Mm. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well done. That was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Really nice story for today. I needed that.
Good. And on that note, subscribe, follow us, tell your mates.
We're done.
And we'll be back next week.
It's just been International Women's Day, and I don't know about you, Phoebs, but around that time, there's always a lot of content that goes out around women and how amazing women are and women inventors and women this and women that. So I've been sent a bunch of videos, which is great.
So have I. Thank you, everyone. It's overwhelming.
It's good, though. It gives us a lot of good ideas. And I can proudly say that there was one video that was going around, I'm not sure if you saw it, with a man going, you know, if a woman hadn't invented these things.
Yeah. You know, it was like, fabulous.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was very proud to say that there was quite a few women in that I was like, we've done her.
Yeah.
We've done her.
Yep.
We've done her. So, yeah, go back and have a listen to, you know, some of the episodes we've done.
Hedy Lamarr, I think, was in there.
Hedy Lamarr, who invented Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. Josephine Cochran, who invented the first dishwasher. We've done Melita Bentz.
Melita, that's right.
Who invented the coffee filter. Mm-hmm. We have also done Mary Anderson, who invented the windscreen wiper.
Yep.
So, yeah, I was really impressed that, you know, a lot of those women in those videos that were being flagged, we had actually highlighted. Yeah. So go back and give those ones a listen.
And if there's anyone that you come across that you think, oh, she sounds amazing, send it through and we'll look into it. I mean, we both got very long lists of our own of, you know, remarkable women that we want to tell you about, but we're always happy to have more.
The one I did last week, the Night Witches, that was actually a recommendation from a friend of mine who is a school teacher, and actually one of his students said to him, you know, "Sir, have you heard about the Night Witches?" And this kid told him all about the Night Witches, and then he messaged me and said, "Have you done this these women on your podcast yet?" So we love it. We love a recommendation. We will we'll be in your ears again next week.
See you then.
Take care, historians. Bye.
Bye.